This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 1989, Barbara Brandon Croft got her own comic strip in the Detroit Free Press. She was so excited that she quit her reporting job at Essence Magazine to pursue being a comic strip artist full time. Problem is, it paid just $75 a week. That's about $180 a week in today's money. So Brandon Croft knew that if she wanted to do it full time, she needed to be published in many more papers. She needed to be nationally syndicated. So she reached out to the syndication companies, and she got a lot of rejection letters. But she also received one yes. And with that, Brandon Croft made history with her comic strip, Where I'm Coming From. And her story and a collection of her comic strips from 1991 to 2005 are in a new book, also titled Where I'm Coming From. And Barbara Brandon Croft joins us today from New York. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I can't tell you what a joy it is to be able to talk with you today. So I'm so grateful that you're with us. I'm wondering if you could start by actually telling us more about that story of how you reached out to the syndication companies, because you wrote a letter, submitted some of your sample comic strips with it, and the letter itself had a pretty vivid style and message in it. What did it say?
It said, "You don't have black women in your comic pages. Here I am. What's the point? I mean, what's the matter? We need to, I don't know, I put them on blast. I just pointed out that there have been comics around forever, and few have been black. None have been women, black women, that is. And I just think they needed to recognize, and I was already published. So I was like, it can happen. I have something that can work. So that's what I did.
Mm. Well, you know, I have to say, from what I understand, the letter was visually arresting also, right? Because you put it in
had a headline.
Yeah. It was like big, bold letters that said, "Few black cartoonists have entered national syndication since the 1970s. None have been black women." Now, I just want to ask, like, when you were processing that and thinking about that very fact when you were sending out these letters, I mean, obviously it's something that you had known for quite some time. How did that strike you? Because you were growing up at a time where there were no black women comic strip artists in the papers that you were reading as a child.
Absolutely. There were very few black comic strips in the papers I was reading at all, you know. But my dad was a pioneering black cartoonist, one of the few who made it into the mainstream press in the late 1960s, and he had a comic strip called Luther. And so I was well aware of the industry. I actually worked on his comic strip some point when I was a little bit older. And so I knew what was happening. I could see it in front of me. And I also knew that if you had one black comic, you're not going to have another. So often my dad would be, we already have Quincy, or we already have Wee Pals. We don't need Luther. So I was well aware of how few black faces were on the comic pages.
And your father was Brumzik Brandon Jr.
That's right.
We're going to talk more about him quite a bit in a few minutes, Barbara. But but I have to say, I admire how much in that letter that you sent to the syndication companies that you kind of lean on what you were hoping were their better angels, right? Because you say, you know, it's the 90s and I'm optimistic. I'd like to see Where I'm Coming From now being self-syndicated, distributed nationally. I only hope racial and sexual attitudes have matured to a point where those in key decision-making positions at newspapers and syndicates recognize the need for social commentary from the black female perspective. Now, when you got all those rejection letters, save one, what did they say?
A lot of them were, you know, your boilerplate. Thanks, but no thanks. Try again. That kind of thing. But I did get one very nice one. It was long, and it was explaining why they didn't think it was going to work, that, you know, I couldn't just do black women. I couldn't just do heads. I had to put them in environments. I had to, if I wanted to think about it differently, they would consider me again. But what I had to offer at that point, they were not interested in, and did not think there'd be enough people interested in looking at it.
Doesn't that sound nuts to you? I mean,
it
like,
sounds
the
insane.
World's most famous comic, Peanuts, is basically just like heads and little squat bodies.
I mean, really? And if you look further down the line, you know, there's some comic strips that are, you know, visually, they're not really hitting and holding. They're just sticks or, you know, assorted other things. But I just wanted to let them know that this is a point of view that you guys are missing. And I think it's already worked in Detroit. I think it can work beyond Detroit.
And it was United Press. Oh, my God. I forgot what the UPS
is. Universal.
Means. Universal.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Universal Press Syndicate. Yes.
That picked you up. So they're the ones who were like, hey, there's something here. And good for them. So
yeah.
So let's go back. You mentioned your father. And I do want to talk about him and your mm-hmm. early life and whether or not becoming a comic strip artist was sort of in your life plan as a little girl. So as we mentioned, your Barbara Brandon Croft's father was Brumzik Brandon Jr., the creator of the comic strip Luther. And that was one of the first nationally syndicated comic strips to feature a mainly black cast of characters. And it began in the late 60s. So here is Brumzik Brandon Jr. in 1998 at Ohio State University talking about you, Barbara.
Some of my neighbors used to try to tease me by saying, I see your daughter's work in the paper. And her work is much better than yours. To which I respond, she had a better teacher.
And thank you to the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum for that clip. So tell us about growing up with your dad, Barbara, and how much his work was part of just your life as a child.
Sure. My dad's a cartoonist all his life. He started selling cartoons, I think, when he was 18. He did many things before Luther happened. And by the time Luther happened, I was, you know, a kid, you know, a young, you know, adolescent. And, you know, we grew up in a small house on Long Island, Newcastle, Long Island. And my dad's studio was our dining room table. So he would set up his situation, you know, pens, papers, pads, light box, the whole thing, do his work, and then take it all down so we could have dinner on the table. I was watching a cartoonist, real life role model, one that I could touch, you know, in my home. And it's kind of interesting because when you're younger and you're in a small house and you're running in and out of the house, we had to actually be quiet during the time when he was working on Luther. Mm-hmm. So he did a daily, I did a weekly. So for every other week, he had to do 2 weeks of Luther. And so for that week that he was working on the 2 weeks, we had to be quiet. And it was just kind of wild to me as a young person. I'm like, this guy is supposed to be a cartoonist. He's supposed to be fun. And we have to, you know, tiptoe around him. And he's mean. You know, he's actually stern at this, you know, at this time. So, but that was just the reality. But I saw the ethic, you know, the work ethic that it took to do a comic strip.
Yeah.
But
you say in the book, where also titled Where I'm Coming From,
yes,
that you knew you were drawn to the visual arts, right? But you didn't necessarily think that becoming a comic strip artist was going to be in your future.
Exactly. I did not. And being rebellious, you know, sometimes you're like, I'm not going to do what my father's doing. Are you kidding me? You know, it's like, that was just my, you know, just me being, you know, as I grew older, I'm like, that's not me. That's him. But it wasn't until I tried to get it. I tried to get a job at a black woman's magazine. And that's when her name's Marie Brown. She was the editor in chief. She's now a literary agent. But she was like, you're kind of funny, you know, do you think, and you draw, you think you can come up with a comic strip? And I was like, yeah, had no idea what I would do. But, you know, I like to say, had my dad been a truck driver, I might not have said, yes, I can do it. But seeing him do it, I actually had the attitude of, hey, if he can do it, I can do it. And I came up with something that she liked.
Wow. Now, so when you, this was when you were at Essence magazine.
This is when I was at Essence, yes.
Okay. And you were the fashion and beauty writer there. Were you also...
Oh, you know what? It's actually the other way around. I took it... I was working at Retail News, and I took it to them, to Elan. And when Elan folded, and before they could publish a strip, I took these strips to Essence. And, you know, they were like, oh, we're thinking about it. Then they were like, I don't think we want to put a comic in the magazine, but what are you doing since you're not making it as a cartoonist? I was like, well, I'm writing fashion for Retail News. And they needed a fashion and beauty writer. And I was like, I know nothing of beauty. They're like, we can teach you. But they gave me a test, editorial test. I took that, and they liked me, and I quit my job. I was like, I'm going to take somebody's place for 4 months at Essence Magazine, but I quit my job. And there I was at Essence. And, you know, lucky for me, the person who had the job before me, Paula White, she decided not to come back. And I stayed there almost 6 years as fashion and beauty writer.
Wow. Now, so eventually, after that inspiration of becoming a comic strip artist, the Detroit Free Press was looking for diverse voices.
Yes.
And I believe they reached out to your father, and he told you to apply?
Well, they sent him he had gotten an award for being one of the pioneer black cartoonists. Mm-hmm. And they sent him a letter, and it was congratulating him and saying, you know, we need our pages to reflect our readership. And do you know of any black cartoonists? And he showed me the letter. He's like, you're going to talk about being a cartoonist? Are you going to be one?
You see the effectiveness of his language. It's very spare, but very precise. It's like the exact same thing that happens in comic strips.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, my guest today is Barbara Brandon Croft. She is the artist behind the legendary comic strip Where I'm Coming From. And she's out with a new book that's a collection of her comic strips from 1991 to 2005. It includes essays and letters as well. We'll talk much more about her career when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are joined by Barbara Brandon Croft. She's a legendary comic strip artist and the force and voice behind the comic Where I'm Coming From. And her latest book, with the same title, is a collection of Where I'm Coming From strips from 1991 to 2005. And it also includes essays and letters about her life, her story, and her story in comics. And we've got a excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. And Barbara, you know, before the break, I talked about how, you know, comics are both this, like, incredibly rich medium that somehow pulls it off with such seemingly... spare artistry. And the reason why I mention that is because I remember as a kid, you know, the first time you get swept up into the world of comics, you just enjoy them at the level that children enjoy things, right? You jump into that world completely. You don't really think about what's going on. But
sure.
When I, as an adult, when I look at comic strips now, I think, how do they do that? Right? I mean, it's just, I don't want to say just, it's, these line drawings in a couple of panels that take me into a world that say so much, that have this beautiful commentary, that carry a story along. Can you talk about your artistry? Like, how does that happen?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. And again, I credit my dad for much of this, of this understanding that you... Because the reality is, if somebody's reading a comic, it's going to... You got their attention for maybe 10 seconds, 15 seconds. So you have to do something, whatever you're going to say, and hopefully you're saying something that, you know, is going to resonate with someone, you have to do it succinctly. You have to find the least amount of words to make this happen. So for me, I write down ideas of what I want to do or what I want to say, and then I try to figure out how I can get to that punchline. You know, what's the dialogue that gets me there? Is it going to be two characters? Is it going to be one? Which ones are they going to be? So that's the way I do it. I come up with the idea, try to figure out how I can say it with the least amount of words, and then put it together.
How long does that take?
So I was lucky because I had a weekly. So unlike my dad who did, 2 weeks of Luther every other week, I had to do two strips every other week. And I would say, because I'm a procrastinator, I could wait until, I've got 3 days to do this. Where were those ideas? How can I do this? So physically, it probably takes me 3 hours, the coming up with the idea and then writing it, that takes the most time.
Yeah. You know what they say about something that looks so easy? That's because it's probably really hard to do, right?
That's what they say, yeah.
So this also, how you're communicating those ideas begins with the style that you decide to draw in, right? And yours is so, so singular. I'm wondering if you could talk about how you decided that you were going to have a cartoon that was telling the story, is telling the story of Black women, just by featuring their faces, their heads, their hairs, and hands, and that's it.
Yeah. So when I first came up with the idea, I was like, I am so tired of women being objectified. I'm so tired of us being thought of in terms of our bodies or our body parts. I wanted to have my characters talking directly to the reader or directly to each other, and the rest of us are kind of eavesdropping on their conversation. But I wanted to make it clear that I'm talking about what is going on in these women's heads, what's on their minds. Look in their eyes, look at their expressions, look at their hands. I only started using hands to be more expressive, but I didn't want to include bodies. And that was one of the complaints I got early on, too. It's like, you can't just do heads. You can't. And it does look odd. It's not a comic strip that you see anywhere. So when Detroit was like, I like this kind of oddball looking strip, and they went with it, which was, I was so pleased to even just get started.
It really does focus you as the reader on what these women are saying. I think it's just so, so effective. But I understand that even the Detroit Free Press early on, was there some concern that the strip would come across as being anti-male?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The very fact that I had a comic strip that had all women and then all Black women, before people even read it, or took a look at it, they would say, they had the notion that I was anti-male and anti-white. And I'm like, wow, I can't even exist on a page without assumptions being made about me. So, sometimes you just let that foister you, like you feel a little more empowered. You're like, these are Black women. Here's an opportunity for a larger segment of society to take a look at a smaller segment and say, huh, that's pretty normal. I was like, yes, we're all humans. We all, worry about, hairs growing out of our chin. I talk about anything from, something like that, something so superficial, to as deep as I wanted to go. Yeah. And so that's... It's interesting to me how there was that concern.
Do you know what? It's making me think just about the comics I used to read as a kid, which was many decades ago. I'll grant you that. And how those, how you're saying that, like, the same assumptions were not foisted on other comic strip artists,
right?
About, like, would you be anti this, anti that? Because I'm thinking, like, okay, I know people are going to just laugh at me or they're going to send me tweets about how this is terrible. But I used to be a huge fan of Andy Capp, of all things.
See?
Right? And, like,
yeah.
I mean, could there be a more misogynistic cartoon comic strip out there? I mean, it's crazy.
I know. It's so true. And even, you know, with just being women, they're like, you know, we already have Kathy. We don't need Where I'm Coming From in our paper. I'm like, hey, women come from different points of view. And not only that, Heathcliff and Garfield can be in the same paper. What?
Cats are allowed to have more than one point of view. Why not women?
Come on.
Sorry, we're laughing now. But I think, you know, this is the thing about America, is that we see, where do we see ourselves, right? And in fact, historically, comic strips have been a really, really, really important place for American stories to be told, right?
And absolutely.
Some of the times they have been, I mean, speaking of racism, I would say that the world of cartoons and comics has sadly been a place where there has been a lot of just horrible racism.
Absolutely.
In the past. So the idea that you had to struggle so much to become the first nationally syndicated black female comic strip artist is disappointing, I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, I'll go back to my dad one more time, but I mean, maybe more than once. But the fact that late '60s, you know, they didn't have black comic characters drawn by black hands in the mainstream. So, like you're talking about, you know, prior to that, blacks were seen on the comic pages as stereotypical, you know, buffoons or, mm-hmm. you know, coons or, you know, it wasn't a place where you could see a real look at what it's like to be a black character. And so then for me, you never saw black women unless we were maids, you know, or, you know, mammies, you know. So it made a difference, I think, for me to be able to have my hands drawing these characters and speaking through their mouths what's on their minds, you know?
Yeah. You know, I wish that I had, when I was a kid, my hometown newspaper did not carry your comic strip. Actually,
oh, shucks.
Maybe I was older then because you were nationally syndicated after 1991. So I'll have to go back and check and see when they ever started carrying it. But I would have loved seeing it as a child. So I'm wondering if we could just talk a little bit more about, like, if you could give us some examples of some of your favorites that are in the new book. And I know that's probably pretty hard to whittle down, but you want to talk about a couple of them?
Sure. You know, I had an opportunity to talk about things, and you know, when we were putting the book together, and I had to go back through strips that I did in the 90s and the 2000s, I was a little worried. You know, I was like, what did I do? You know, because you do it, you put it out there, and it's gone. Because like with you, it wasn't in a New York paper. I was living in Brooklyn. It wasn't in a New York paper. But a lot of major cities out there had it. So I did it, sent it out there, and kind of left it, you know, let it go. So now that I go back and look at what I was talking about, what's most striking to me is that we're talking about the same things and things that have not been resolved. You know, surprise, surprise, are still an issue. So, you know, I did pick out a few. This one got me in trouble. But if you're going to talk about rights to abortion, that's going to get you in trouble. And so I'll just read this one. And this particular character is Lakeisha, and she's the most socially conscious, and she's the most militant, I'll say. But this is her. And she says, I cannot believe these anti-abortionists. I mean, how can you say pro-choice equals murder? Murder is a sin. And if you don't agree with us, we'll kill you. That was a strip that I did in the 90s.
Wow.
And that's when, you know, abortion clinics were being bombed. Doctors were being shot. But it some people found it offensive. And, you know, you can't please everybody, obviously. But that's one that I did way back when.
Can I just ask you quickly, how do you decide how to, I mean, those are powerful words accompanied by by her face and her expression? Like, how do you decide what expression to give to those words?
The mirror. You know, it's you kind of exaggerate how you actually feel to give that expression to your characters. But yeah, that's how I do it. You know, that's how I did it. That's how I do it. So, you know, you maybe exaggerate the expressions a little bit, but that's how I find it.
Yeah.
Right, well, in my reflection.
So Speaking of which, how many of your characters are sort of inspired by you or people around you?
I would say all of them.
Yeah. So
I identify with Lakeisha. She's, you know, very socially conscious. She's, you know, is up on the news and, you know, knows what's going on in the world. But I'm also Jackie, who's like very anxious, me, who's worried about things that she shouldn't. Like, I worried about my hair coming to the radio show. That's crazy, Barbara. That's the kind of thing that I have. I'm like, is my hair okay? It's like, what difference does it make, Barbara? But all of them are either parts of me or parts of friends or both.
Yeah.
Little aspects of me and little, you know, portions of friends that I can stick in and come up with a, you know, a character. Mm.
Barbara, could you share another one of the strips that are included in the book? Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. I was thinking, so what I also did was include some post-syndication strips, because I still do it. I still create Where I'm Coming From. I don't have a syndicate, but, you know, I'll put it on my Instagram or something. But this character is Cheryl, and Cheryl's kind of snarky and opinionated. And unfortunately, you can't see her expressions, but here's one. And she says, I know it's important to be respectful of folks with opinions other than my own. I know a dialogue between the right and the left is necessary to help this nation mend. I want to be a part of this solution, but, and she kind of shrugs her shoulders, for the life of me, I can't figure out how to have a conversation without saying, don't be a moron. Oops.
You're catching me in an honest moment here. If I were at home in my kitchen reading that, that's exactly what I would have done. Oh gosh. Here I am worried about getting in trouble about laughing on the radio. I mean, what kind of trouble did you get into over your career with some of this edgy stuff?
Yeah. I got letters for those same reasons. You know, I'm being anti-male, or I am being anti-white. Honestly, those kind of letters kind of made me feel good, because I'm like, huh, I pushed your buttons, did I? You know, it makes you feel good that you reached somebody on that level. You know, but back then when I was doing stuff, it wasn't like times are now, where people can just whip out their phones and start their thumbs flying to, you know, bring you down, or, you know, talk about how much they don't like what you're doing. They had to actually, you know, get a piece of paper and pen and find an envelope, get a stamp, take it to the mailbox, you know. So I'm like, wow, you took a lot of effort just to tell me that you don't like what I'm doing.
Well, you'd think those things would be obstacles, but obviously it didn't stop folks, right?
No,
I mean, some of the
no.
feedback, I call it feedback, but some of the criticism you got was pretty vicious, like people telling you to, you know, quote, go back to Africa.
Yeah, and take Jesse Jackson with me. I was like, huh? I mean, that's ridiculous. I was like, and you kind of have to laugh at that kind of nonsense. I got a letter from a guy saying that he was very upset with what I was doing, and I was anti-male, and this is no way to, you know, show, there's no room for all this. And, you know, I would write people back on occasion, and I wrote him back, and I just said, I don't know if you notice, but if you read my strip, I usually don't say men. I'm talking about a specific man, you know, like there's Maurice and Victor. There's certain guys that are part of the strip that you never see. But I said, but if you see yourself in something that somebody's one of my characters is complaining about in this particular guy, then really, where is the problem? Is it me or is it you?
Yeah, like, that's on you.
Yeah. What?
Oh, wow. Well, so we've got about 30 seconds before we have to go to our next break here. Was there ever a strip that you had conceived that you decided in the end that you weren't going to do because it was maybe too edgy?
No. Short answer. No, I just did them.
That was the answer I was hoping for, Barbara. Yeah. Well, my guest today is Barbara Brandon Croft, the legendary artist behind the comic strip Where I'm Coming From. And we'll talk a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I just want to give you a heads up about something we're working on for next week because we want your participation in this show. Next week, we're going to be doing a program about the beauty of nighttime and darkness, specifically that particular darkness, obviously, that only comes at night. And we'll be talking about the entire world and ecosystems and animals that thrive and depend on nighttime. So here's what we want you to do. I'd love it if you could take your phone out with you. Sorry, but yes, we rely on your phone for this. Go outside at night where you are, take your phone, and describe to us what you see. Do you have a clear view of the Milky Way, or is there a lot of light pollution where you are? What do you hear? Are there particular animals that you know are surrounding you at night? What do you smell? What do you feel? Describe your experience of nighttime to us by taking your phone out in the darkness. And you can record your message on the On Point Vox Pop app, which is available wherever you download your apps. Just look for On Point Vox Pop. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, I am speaking with Barbara Brandon Croft. She is the legendary comic strip artist behind the strip Where I'm Coming From. She was the first Black female cartoonist to be nationally syndicated in America's newspapers. And her latest book is also called Where I'm Coming From, and it's a compilation of comic strips from 1991 to 2005, plus essays and letters from across her storied career. And we've got an excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. And Barbara, if I may, there's there's a strip right at the beginning of the book that just makes me laugh every time I read it. So I want to read it to you and just tell me a little bit of the story about this one. It's right there at the top. It's where the character's saying, "Vernon and I have been seeing each other for nearly 5 years. I still haven't figured out the attraction. Even after all these years, I still don't feel like we're close. I bet he couldn't even tell you what my favorite food is. Yesterday, Vernon told me how proud he was that I'd finished college, got my MBA, and opened my own business. He called us serious and said he'd finally found a woman worthy of his ultimate commitment. So I mailed him my resume this morning and told him he could marry that."
That was an early one. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but so tell me about this is again one of those issues and stories that can only come uniquely from the perspective of a Black woman, right? Because you're not just talking about marriage in general. You're talking about Black women and relationships and marriage.
I'm talking about that Black woman and in relationships and marriages. And you know, I recognize that, you know, sometimes you can be so accomplished and you find yourself in a relationship, and you wonder about it. And when they come off with something like, you know, you know, they've checked off all their notches, you know, oh, she's this, she's this, she's this. Okay, she's good enough for me. And she's like, what? You can marry my resume if that's what's impressing you.
Okay, well, you know, just so that we get our history right, you are the eighth comic strip artist to be nationally syndicated, and your father was the third, right?
Yeah, it's something like that.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, the dates. But also, we always have to make sure we say mainstream press, because there's a whole host of cartoonists that were in the black press. And the first woman who was in newspapers was in the black press, and her name was Jackie Orms. And she did a number of cartoons, but her things were all but lost because they were in the black press.
Mm.
And, you know, but now she's getting her, you know, roses, so to speak, and people are recognizing it. My distinction is that I crossed the color line.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say mainstream press, but I really mean white press.
Mm.
And same with my dad. One of my dad's heroes was Oliver Harrington, who was in the black press. But a lot of people have lost. That's lost to a lot of people. But my dad and, you know, Ted Shearer and Maury Turner came along with my dad at the same time. And so they crossed the color line and became cartoonists in the white press, just as I did become a syndicated cartoonist in the mainstream press.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so once again, just to remind folks, Barbara's father is Brumzik Brandon Jr., who brought the world Luther.
Yes.
And we have another clip of him speaking. This is from a 1991 interview he gave on CBS News. And he was asked about the impact cartoons have on public opinion and policy.
I think it's very, very important. I don't think it can be stressed enough. I think Thomas Nast determined that many, many years ago when Boss Tweed, I think it was, said he didn't mind what they wrote about him in the newspapers because his constituency couldn't read. But get rid of those damn cartoons. So I'm certain that still applies.
Because they make a point with brevity and with conciseness and with a kind of penetration.
Absolutely.
That sticks right in.
So, Barbara, what do you think about that?
I think my dad was right. he was very funny. That interview was before I was syndicated. I was only in the one paper, and it was interesting to be on there with my dad talking about cartoonists and the importance of cartooning. And that seems like it's part of my blood, really, mm-hmm. and realizing that this is such a way to communicate ideas, and it's also a way to record our history. And so I look at myself as a, you know, conscientious history reporter. You know, I record our history. It's a cultural commentator. You know, I try to do exactly what he was talking about. It's important to as he would say, observe, interpret, and record. And it's a unique way doing it through cartoons,
mm-hmm.
To get those points across and to record history.
Yeah. You know, and also, of course, many, many people enjoy comic strips as adults. But I also think that their importance kind of is double or even triple because comics are an entree for young people into the very kind of issues that you're talking about, Barbara. Like I remember one of my kiddos, she was a particular fan of Calvin and Hobbes, right? Just
yes.
Like addicted to Calvin and Hobbes. And occasionally she'd come to me with a question about like some philosopher or some, you know, random existential question. I'd be like, where did you learn about that? And she'd be like, it was in today's Calvin and Hobbes. And I'm like, oh my gosh. But I mean, that's kind of a lighthearted example of what I'm trying to get at is that this is a medium in which young people can be introduced, you know, to the very ideas that you put in your strip for so long about the lives of Black women, about racism, about things like that. Did you ever think about that as you were writing the strip?
I think as I was writing it, you know, this early iteration, I was just putting it out there. You know, I was like, you know, it was bubbling out of me. There are things that I wanted to talk about, and I talked about it. But since I realized I have a cousin in San Francisco who talks to her grandkids about my strip, two boys, you know, she'll have them read it and have them discuss it. And that's really flattering to me, you know, that I could put some ideas out there that spur this kind of conversation, especially in younger people. This woman told me that her daughter, who's 13, looked at my stuff and said, "Ma, she's funny. She could be doing this now." And like, I love the idea that young people can look at my work and get something from it.
Yeah.
It's really great.
Well, this is what I think is so wonderful about comics, right? It's like seemingly a disarming medium, but you can really hit people with some big ideas.
Absolutely.
Now,
yeah.
So tell me more then. We talked about some of the negative feedback that you got, but you must have received lots of positive feedback as well as people who had never had a chance to have this kind of story told in their newspaper, you know, were seeing your work.
Yeah, I got a lot of really nice letters. A lot of times women would write and say that I was telling their story, and they'd never experienced that. You know, especially in Detroit when that first started, they were like, "Wow, I look forward to Sundays to look at to see what she's going to talk about my life in this time." And since then, I've met women. There's a reporter in New York who said that she used to, when she was working in Texas, that she used to cut out my strip and put it as like a letterhead when she wrote her friends, because it wasn't everywhere. It was in a lot of major cities, but I thought that was pretty, it made, you know, warm my heart to know that she would, you know, actually cut it out. She'd cut it out, put it on her wall, and she'd cut it out and use it as a header for her letters to friends, just to spread the word.
Huh.
And that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I love that. Now, there's one more. I mean, we could talk about many more things regarding your father's work, but I know there's something in particular that you wanted to discuss, because there's an exhibit, right,
yes,
that portrays your father's work and your work together. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So we put together an exhibit here in New York with Tara Nakashima Donahue as the curator. And we put together several exhibits, but we did one here in New York. And the exhibit's called Still, Racism in America, a Retrospective in Cartoons. So what we used were things from my dad, not just Luther, things he did for Freedom Ways, which is a Black journal that was started, you know, way back when, and my dad was a part of. He would do editorial cartoons for them. We include some Luthers, which, you know, are at the Billy Ireland Museum at Ohio State University. And we include things that my dad did post-Luther, which he did for Florida Today and different places. He did a lot. Prolific. But we put together an exhibit of his work and my work. And what's astounding, and maybe not so much, is that we would talk about the same things 30 years apart, easily. So what we do is put the strips on the wall, and the only thing we would put there would be the year that this came out. And it's kind of profound to see how little we've moved the mark. You know, we are still struggling with dealing with racism. And so the Billy Ireland, when we opened in New York, that's when COVID hit and there was a lockdown, and that was the end of the story. But the, you know, when Ohio State called and said, "We could put it in the Billy Ireland," I was like, "What?" And, you know, they brought us out there. We put together a really, you know, break my arm, pat myself on the back, but a really incredible exhibit. And then that ended, you know, the exhibits last. But now we're talking with and making it happen at the University of UC Davis is what I'm trying to say, and bringing it out there. So for 2024, it's going to live again. And I hope it gets to travel because it's a real education. Maybe I can get it in Florida. They could use an education.
You know, Barbara, I have to say your humility just amplifies your tremendousness in my mind. Because listen, you are a pioneer. You're a pathbreaker. You get to own that. You get to celebrate that. You don't have to worry about breaking your arm, patting yourself on the back. Well, I'll pat you on the back then. Save your arm, okay?
Thank you.
But I do want to ask you. You know, I don't know if this is something that you actively think about, but being a pioneer, do you ever wonder or do you think about what you want your legacy to be?
I guess what I think about, because, you know, actually I've been asked, you know, that kind of thing, and it makes me feel like, oh, my God, what do you mean? I'm a, you know, it makes me feel a little uneasy. But I do like being thought of as somebody who accurately recorded our history and who accurately told the story of what these nine black women were going through in the 90s and now, you know, currently, because I still use them, I still do it. So I don't know. I think I'd like to have that as my legacy, that I told the story and I told it honestly.
Mm. Well, so how much do you think the world of cartooning and comic strips has changed after you crossed that color line and opened those doors?
I think that once I got in, I was feeling very good and proud. And, you know, and I'll say rightly so. I should be proud. I was feeling very good and proud because I knew I'd broken down the door. But I also felt like I was standing in the door because nobody else could get in. You know, it's like, we have Barbara. We don't need anybody else. And that was kind of a weird feeling, too. I'm glad that, you know, since I've moved on, you know, that there are other cartoonists out there, women cartoonists, that are making things happen. And black women cartoonists syndicated two of them, or at least now. There's another woman in The New Yorker regularly. Mm-hmm. There's Jennifer Crute. There are a lot of black cartoonists that are out there that are women, and they're doing it. And I hope that, you know, after I unclogged the door, that I offered some path for them.
Well, you most certainly did. And I keep thinking about what you said earlier. If we could have multiple comic strips about cats, we should be having dozens of comic strips about black women at the very least. So
yeah.
So you weren't standing in the doorway. It's just that the door wasn't being made wider for a long time. So
yeah, for a long time.
Barbara Brandon Croft, the legendary comic strip artist behind Where I'm Coming From. She's got a new book out with the same title. It's a collection of her strips from 1991 to 2005. Also includes essays and letters from her career. We've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Barbara, it's been such a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it, Magda.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.